Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before we begin today's exposition, if you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, you will discover there some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We've come to chapter 10. By no means are we to think that these narratives encompass the whole of the military or political activities of King David. The author gives us only what suits his literary purposes. Those purposes, in turn, are guided by the Holy Spirit. It is safe to assume, I think, that the next narrative here in chapter 10, which concerns the Ammonite conflict, more or less marks the apex of David's ascent to power, and it also is an occasion where David breaks the messianic type, as it were, and shows us the great peril of great power in the hands of even a godly man. Right here in this Ammonite war, we have the precursor to a great sin on the part of David that will lead to consequences that will plague his reign and his house for the rest of his reign and cause David no end of grief. We will see in the process how guilt, though David confesses his sin, still gnaws at him and robs him of his high moral ground and plays a role in the family tragedies that follow. Lord Acton has famously said, "Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." Well, David was a man under God, and because of his sense of accountability to God, subjectively at least, his power was never absolute. Yet, by God's blessing, David attained immense stature in his part of the world, and his military might was such that the enemies of Israel were pretty impotent in resisting him. The weakness of fallen human nature is such that it is hard for us mortals not to succumb to some of the downward gravity that too much power brings with it. Too much power tends to draw even the best of men down to some degree, and we will see that play out in the life of David. You know, as a pertinent sidebar, I have now lived long enough to be glad that I was not one of those pastors or Christian leaders who ascended to prominence at a relatively early age, as some do. I haven't ascended to prominence at any age, but certainly not at a relatively early age, as I have seen some do. Though I do not know all of them in my own generation by any means, from what I have seen up close and from afar, fame and what we sometimes call Christian celebrity, which is a form of power, has an amazing way of degrading those who find it, most especially those who find it prematurely, in a great many cases. It was too great a burden for their flesh to bear in many cases. They began to think of themselves, those who achieve notoriety at an early age, they began to think of themselves as stars. They get proud, they get cocky, they start, as we used to say in West Virginia, living above their raisin. They get too good for all the little people who help them along. They are so sure of themselves they can't listen to anybody but their fellow Christian stars, and not uncommonly, as they grow older, they mess up and their halo slips. Unaccountable power will do that to a man or a woman, because after all, no matter how big we get in our britches, we're all just fallen people, and we all, big or small, need great grace to keep us on keel. But once a person finds Christian notoriety or celebrity, I tell you, it's just amazing how quickly they can forget that. Then the Lord has to take them down a few notches in one way or another. Now, all of this is a prelude to the text. I would cite a few examples, but of course, that would not be appropriate. But you watch it, and you will, I think, see it for yourself, especially in the cases of those who come into the limelight too early in their careers. They are like shooting stars who create a sensation for a while on the horizon, and then like a 4th of July sparkler, they are gone. Remember, David became king when he was 30 years old, but he was at least a mature 30 years old, which most 30-year-olds today distinctly are not. Now it happened afterwards that the king of the Ammonites died. Hanun, his son, became king in his place. Well, David had a good thought. He said, I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent some of his servants to console him concerning his father, a diplomatic mission of consolation, but an unexpected development. When David's servants came to the land of the Ammonites, the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun, their lord, do you think that David is honoring your father because he has sent consolers to you? Don't bet on it. Has not David sent his servants to you in order to search out the city? They've come to spy it out and to overthrow it. Well, Hanun listened to his advisors. He took David's servants. He shaved off half of their beards and cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips and sent them away. Of course, that was a complete humiliation and indignity, not just to them, but to the government that sent them. Well, when word got back to David, he sent messengers to meet them, for the men were greatly humiliated. And the king said, stay at Jericho until your beards are grown, then return. Now, when the sons of Ammon saw that they had become odious to David, they hired mercenaries. They hired the Syrians out of Beth Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and also the king of Maacah with 1,000 men and the men of Tob with 12,000 men. When David heard of it, he sent Joab and all of the army and his mighty men. And the sons of Ammon came out, and they drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city, while the Syrians of Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the field. And then follows the account of how Joab managed by strategy to defeat them. Generally, relations with Israel's jealous neighbors were tense, if not outright hostile. And the Ammonites were located on Israel's eastern flank. They were no exception. At some point, however, the Ammonite king, Nahash, whom Saul ingloriously defeated at Jabesh Gilead early in his reign, he had shown some kindness to David. That is not recorded here, but just alluded to. My best guess is that when David was being pursued by Saul as public enemy number one, these eastern neighbors, Ammon and Moab, were only too willing to support and give safe haven to David on the principle that if your enemy is also our enemy, you are our friend. That political reality makes sense. It would explain the otherwise unexplained, why Nahash, the king of Ammon, Israel's natural and protracted enemy, would have done David any favors. In any case, whatever goodwill thereby existed between David and the king of Ammon, well, that capital was quickly exhausted by Nahash's foolish royal successor on the occasion of the death of Nahash. Unfounded suspiciousness or paranoia, folks, is the mother of much imprudence and folly. Anytime we feel threatened, justly or unjustly, we humans are prone to bad judgment, and we're prone to making moves that put things on a bad course. That's why President Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1941 told our nation when Pearl Harbor was attacked, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. There's a good lesson for all of us believers. We must not allow ourselves, whether the threats and the hostile giants we face are real or imagined, we must not allow ourselves to be ruled by fear. For fear is a very bad counselor in times of anxiety or conflict. The best antidote to fear is our faith and the character, the power, the promises, and the faithfulness of our God. as the Psalm so redundantly teaches. Nahash's successor and his advisors were classic men of the world in the sense that they did not know God. Therefore, they did neither have nor seek his guidance in this matter. In sending royal envoys to Hanun, the son of Nahash, possibly on the occasion of state funeral of the father, David's intentions were totally honorable. They were an expression of political goodwill. However, Hanun's royal advisors suspiciously saw in David's noble gesture nothing of the kind. On the contrary, they advised the new regent of Ammon that these envoys of David's were really intelligence officers in disguise. Their real intention, they told him, at least they suspected, was not to console the Ammonite king in the loss of his father at all. Their real agenda was to take measure of the land of the Ammonites while they were on the property, so to speak, assess its strengths and its weaknesses and its resources, all with future military designs in mind. So their fear-driven counsel proved to be eventually a disaster for Ammon and all of her allies. So without any real provocation, but mere cynical suspicion driven by fear, they decided to humiliate the state-appointed embassy from Israel and King David. They executed this humiliation by violating their dignity. They did so by symbolic actions whose codes were well understood as major insults in the political language of the day. They shaved off half their beards. They cut off their robes in the middle, as far as their hips, and in that state sent them packing like a group of jackals. Well, once David's humiliated embassy crossed the Jordan River in their disgraced appearance, they managed to send word from friendly Jericho about their shameful treatment, though it was no fault of their own that they suffered such degrading treatment at the hands of a now clearly hostile neighbor. There was no way that David wanted them reappearing in Jerusalem in that state of dress or undress, half-dress, and appearance. For their coming into the capital city in that condition would reflect poorly on the esteem in which David and his government were held by the hostile Ammonites, and it would be an insult to the whole nation, and David was having none of that. So he sent them orders to remain at Jericho, quote, until your beards be grown and then return. I never read that expression without thinking of something that Charles Spurgeon said. He made an interesting use of that royal direction that I will share with you. Spurgeon was once asked what he thought about reinstating into the gospel ministry pastors who had been disgraced, or rather who disgraced themselves by discreditable behaviors. Yes or no? I always thought Spurgeon's answer was very wise. While he did not in his own mind absolutely disallow the propriety of admitting the once disgraced but repentant back into the gospel ministry, on this point, Spurgeon said he was very firm. Let them remain at Jericho until their beards be grown. Translation, keep them out of the pulpit until their repentance is as widely known as their sin. Of course, by repentance, he meant what the word replies, not just sorrowful confession of sin, but evidence of a change of mind that has caused them to turn away from the sin or sins that originally brought them into discredit and disrepute. Well, in verse 6 of chapter 10, with that egregious insult to Israel and David, the Ammonites burned their bridges politically. There was no way a self-respecting political entity could suffer that insult lying down. It had to be answered, else every jackleg nation that hated Israel would read into David's passivity that Israel was weak. In a sinful world, no self-respecting nation can afford to send that message. Witness our national response to the sinking of the Maine, the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, and the infamous 9-1-1 attack on the Twin Towers in New York City. Governments exist to protect their citizens from danger and threats, internal and external. Governments are God's instruments for that very purpose, among others. So David, as we would expect, responded in a measure justified by the symbolic assault on his government. And David intended to send a message to all and sundry that messing with Israel was not good policy. For, as David knew, it was not just his throne and his citizens that were involved in this disgraceful treatment, but the Ammonites had insulted the true king of Israel, Yahweh, of whom David was only his visible human representative. So David got the picture, just as he had in the case of Goliath, who insulted Israel's God in insulting the king and the army of Israel. And David is about to set out in God's name to avenge this disgraceful treatment. Well, when the Ammonites saw how their attempt to teach David a lesson had backfired in their national face, the text says they became odious to David. In panic, they went into a state of military emergency. That military mobilization included hiring other hostile nations, especially troops from the Syrians to the north, but others too, the king of Maacah and the men of Tob, 12,000. They hired these to join them in a great military alliance just to take David out once and for all. Immediately, David took counteraction. By now, he had a great and well-trained army, and he had some great generals with Joab at the head of central command. So he sent them into the field. Now, the Ammonite war strategy, and as we see in this text, was to catch David's army in advance. The mercenary troops would descend from the north, while the Ammonite force would fight Israel from the other direction. The idea was to hit them hard from the front and the rear, verse 9. Of course, that strategy is lethal if you can maneuver an invading force into that position. And that's exactly what they had going for them. There was just one problem. The army of Israel had God on their side. For the Lord, as we have seen from these inspired narratives, is with David so long as David is faithful to him. God aims to make David succeed, and succeed his army will, despite all the might and the clever tactics arrayed against him. You see, when God is for us, David or anyone else, who can be against us, as Paul says in Romans 8? It is that message, among others, that we are to get. When the Lord helps us, folks, we are helped. When the Lord goes before us, nothing or no one can stand against us. When Joab grasped the military situation, he did not panic. Calmly, he took the elite troops of Israel and faced off against the Syrians coming from the north. They comprised the majority of the mercenary army hired by the Ammonites. Perhaps he did this because he considered them a greater threat. Or else, he did this because being a hired army, he felt their mercenary motivation would not sustain them when faced with a truly motivated and fierce fighting force, as his elite troops were, and Joab proved to be right. In war, superior troops, armaments, and tactics go a long way for a victorious outcome. But if other things are anywhere near equal, one must never underestimate the power of the moral high ground, which Israel had in this battle. Moral outrage is a mighty weapon. Well, the rest of the Israelite troop Joab placed under the command of his also gifted general brother, Abishai. When Joab saw that the battle was set against him, in front and in the rear, he selected from all the choice men of Israel, he arrayed them against the Syrians. The remainder of the people he placed in the hand of Abishai's brother. He arrayed them against the sons of Ammon. And he said, if the Syrians prove too strong for me, then you'll help me. If the sons of Ammon are too strong for you, then I'll come and help you. So be strong. Let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to battle against the Syrians. And long and short, the Syrians fled before him. Well, that panicked the sons of Ammon. When they saw the Syrians fled, they fled before Abishai. And they entered their city and hid behind its walls. And this is going to set up the great downfall of David. Then Joab returned from fighting against the sons of Ammon, and he came to Jerusalem. When the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they wanted to have another go at it. They gathered themselves together. They got another fighting force. It was told David. He gathered all Israel together, crossed the Jordan, came to Helam. The Syrians arrayed themselves to meet David, and they fought against him. But once again, the Syrians fled before Israel. David killed 700 charioteers of the Syrians, 40,000 horsemen, and struck down Shobach, the commander of the army. So the Syrians got off that jag real quick, and they feared to help the sons of Ammon anymore. So now they're just dealing with the Ammonites. Knowing that they were in a perilous situation, then the two general brothers held a kind of pep rally between themselves and their troops. Battle's a serious business. Soldiers can be cowards or courageous, just depending on the moment. It always helps if one has not rushed into the fray thoughtlessly about potential cost. It always helps The Lord told us this, to count the cost in advance and resolve to be courageous, not cowardly before the fact, rather than in the heat of the battle try to find courage. So the leaders encouraged one another and their troops before ever a shot was fired, so to speak. They talked in verse 12 about being courageous. They talked about what was at stake. They were facing this mighty coalition of hostile neighbors. Everything was on the line. Before one ever joins a fight, it's a good thing to measure whether it is worth it all and be prepared to suffer what it takes. This fight, Joab and Abishai told their fighting men, was about nothing petty. What was at stake was our people, the people of God no less, the cities of our God. The enemies had designs on David and his kingdom, and they intended at the end of the day, if possible, to destroy or enslave the population, a population which belonged to God. They intended to destroy the cities of the Promised Land, which belonged to God. In short, their aim was to lay waste to what belonged to Yahweh, the God of Israel, to embarrass his name and his claims. There was all the incentive the army of Israel needed to fight to the last breath. So Joab, flawed as he was, spiritually speaking, saw the engagement on the level that it existed, as really a religious warfare that went right to the heart of the theocracy, which stood for God in his possession. Israel as a nation belonged to God. So Joab and his forces were fighting not for themselves or for mere political advantage. It was, in a real sense, for the honor of God. And therein lay their moral high ground in this fight. And that's what God's people are always supposed to be about honoring and magnifying God, about protecting his interest as he leads. If we are right in our judgment about what glorifies him, and we do the right thing in the right way, God will support us. As we reflect on this campaign against the Ammonites and the Syrian coalition, it brings to mind Jesus' parable in undertaking a life of discipleship. He said, count the cost. The Lord wants us to follow him into this spiritual warfare against a coalition of the world, the flesh, and the devil. He wants us to go with eyes wide open. He wants us to know it could cost us everything this world considers desirable. By the grace of God, we should consider what is at stake in our warfare, the glory of Christ, and we should resolve mentally, by the help of the grace of God, not to be double-minded, but to acquit ourselves like men. We should determine beforehand, before the first blow is struck, to be courageous and prepared to lay it all on the line in his service. You can't be a disciple of Christ on lesser terms. So, be strong and let us show ourselves courageous for the glory of God. You don't wait until the price gets unexpectedly high and then bail. I'm not talking about taking a bullet for Jesus, if it comes to that, or languishing in some prison like Paul for the sake of Christ. For most of us, the test of loyalty that the Lord sends are of less consequence. And yet, in this spiritual warfare that we find ourselves in, people surrender to the enemy in all kinds of circumstances. So many folk who fly under the banner of Christ, when push comes to shove, prove they're unprepared to enter the ranks and fight for the Lord on terms that are strong and courageous. They're only too ready to throw down their shield and capitulate to temptation. Folk refuse to pull out the stops and just live recklessly for Christ at whatever cost. The battle may be raging on all sides, but hey, they will quit the fight rather than imperil their personal dreams, their business interest, their companionship issues, and all of that kind of thing. We just don't want to go there, dear friends. Their battle was against the Ammonites and the Syrians. Our battle is against the world, the flesh, and the devil. But we have to plan in advance, by the grace of God, to be strong. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.